Vaikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Vaikatra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, we love tackling those big questions here, the ones that kind of shape how we understand the world.
Absolutely.
And today we're diving into maybe one of the biggest economic mysteries out there. Why did the Industrial Revolution kick off in Britain? Specifically Britain, around what, the late 1700s?
Yeah, around 1760 is the usual marker. It's the fundamental question, isn't it? Why there? Why then? And not, say, China or France or somewhere else. They were advanced civilizations, too.
For ages, the stories were about, oh, British culture or their scientific minds, maybe just some lucky inventors popping up.
Right, those traditional narratives.
Yeah.
But the work we're focusing on today, mostly from Robert C. Allen's books, like The Industrial Revolution and his very short introduction, well, it offers a really different take.
And that's what makes it so interesting, so powerful, really. Allen basically says, forget the vague cultural stuff for a moment. Look at the hard economics. Mm-hmm. He argues the whole thing happened in Britain because, uniquely, it was the only place where inventing and using those new machines actually made financial sense. It was a straightforward business decision.
That's the core idea we want to unpack in this deep dive. It wasn't destiny. It wasn't just brilliant sparks. It was a very specific set of prices. Wages were high. Energy was cheap. That combination created this huge incentive.
An incentive to mechanize in Manchester that just didn't exist in, say, Paris or Beijing at that time. Even if they had the same ideas, the numbers wouldn't have worked.
Precisely. It makes the whole thing feel less like magic and more like, well, economic logic playing out.
Okay, before we get into the nitty-gritty of wages and coal, let's talk about the man himself, Robert C. Allen. He's often called a quantitative historian. What does that actually mean in practice?
Well, he's a highly respected economic historian, professor emeritus now at Oxford, got his PhD in economics from Harvard. But what really makes his work stand out is the sheer rigor, the data.
Right.
He wasn't just reading old letters or government reports, though those are important too, of course.
Right.
He spent decades literally reconstructing historical data, wages, prices of goods, rents, across different countries, over centuries.
So less about anecdotes, more about spreadsheets.
You could say that, yeah. He built these incredible data sets that allow for actual comparison. Like, how much bread could a carpenter in London buy with an hour's wage in 1750 compared to one in Florence or Amsterdam?
That sounds painstaking.
Immensely. But it's crucial. Because his argument rests entirely on understanding the specific economic reality faced by people making decisions back then. It's that quantitative bedrock that lets him make such a powerful case about why things happened where they did.
Got it. So let's get to that core argument then. You said it was about a unique economic structure in Britain. What exactly were the key pieces?
It boils down to two main things, really. First, Britain had uniquely high wages relative to other places and relative to the cost of capital.
Okay, high wages.
And second, they had uniquely cheap energy, mainly because of incredibly abundant and accessible coal.
Right. So the cost of labor was high, but the cost of the stuff needed to replace that labor machines, which represent capital, and the coal to power them was comparatively low.
Exactly. Allen talks about factor prices, the relative costs of labor, capital, and energy. In Britain, that specific ratio, high labor cost versus low energy capital cost, created a huge, powerful incentive for businesses.
An incentive to do what specifically?
To invent and adopt technologies that saved on the expensive factor, which was labor, and used more of the cheap factors, capital and energy. Think machines powered by coal.
That feels so backwards, doesn't it? We usually hear politicians worry about high wages killing jobs or hurting competitiveness.
I know. It's completely counterintuitive to how we often think today. But Allen flips it. He says those high wages weren't the problem. They were the solution. Or rather, the catalyst. They forced innovation.
Because if you're a factory owner and your workers are costing you a fortune,
your most rational move isn't just to grumble, it's to figure out, how can I get the same output with fewer of these expensive workers? And the answer staring you in the face was, build a machine and power it with that cheap coal down the road.
So in Manchester, investing in a spinning mill makes sense on the balance sheet. The cost of the machine, the loan, the coal, it was less than paying all those spinners.
Correct. But if you tried to build that same mill in France, where wages were much lower and maybe coal was more expensive or harder to get,
it just wouldn't pay off. You'd lose money.
Exactly. They might have known how to build it. The technology wasn't necessarily a secret, but it would have been economic suicide to actually do it there at that time. the incentives were completely different.
And this unique setup allowed Britain to break free from something that had trapped humanity for basically all of history, the Malthusian trap. Can you remind us what that was?
Yeah, the Malthusian trap, named after Thomas Malthus, basically describes the world before, say, 1800. Anytime a society got a little bit better at producing things, maybe a new crop rotation, a slightly better tool, what happened?
More food, healthier people.
So the population grew, and pretty soon all those extra mouths ate up the surplus. Living standards might flicker upwards for a bit, but they'd always fall back to just subsistence level.
Mm-mm.
Per person, there was basically zero long-term economic growth. It was a cycle of temporary gains followed by population catching up.
Grim. But Alan shows Britain was somehow different. They had already started escaping this even before the big inventions.
Yes, that's a key part of his argument. His data shows that London, in particular, had exceptionally high real wages compared to the rest of Europe, especially after about 1650. People could afford more calories, better goods.
And that wasn't just random luck. What drove those high wages?
It seems to be a mix of things. Britain had a very successful mercantile empire, bringing in wealth from trade. Its agriculture was becoming quite commercialized and productive, freeing up labor for other sectors. And crucially, London was booming again. Urbanization drove up demand for workers.
Okay, so high demand for labor pushing wages up. And then, critically, alongside that,
they had the cheapest energy in the world. Britain was basically built on coal, and much of it was near the surface, easy to mine, especially compared to trying to get energy from wood, which was becoming scarce and expensive.
So you have this incredible pressure cooker situation, the most expensive workers on the planet living right next door to the cheapest, most potent fuel source.
That's the engine. That's what Alan calls induced innovation. The prices themselves induced the specific type of technological change that occurred.
Let's make that concrete. Textiles are always the classic example of the Industrial Revolution. How does Alan's logic apply there?
Perfectly. Think about making cloth. Before machines, spinning the thread was the major bottleneck. It took tons of labor, mostly women working at home. And in Britain, that labor was costly.
So inventions like Hargreaves' spinning jenny or Arkwright's water frame?
They weren't designed in a vacuum. They were very specifically designed to reduce the amount of expensive labor needed to produce a given amount of yarn. The goal wasn't just make a machine. The goal was save money on spinners.
Use capital, the machine, and eventually energy, water power, then coal power to replace human hours.
Precisely. Alan even runs the numbers. He shows that investing in a spinning jenny offered a fantastic rate of return in high-wage England in the 1770s. But if you took that same machine to France with its lower wages,
with savings wouldn't cover the cost of the machine.
Exactly. It wouldn't have been profitable. So the innovation was tailored almost perfectly to the specific factor prices found in Britain. That's why they led the way in textiles.
Okay, let's shift to the technology everyone pictures when they think Industrial Revolution, the steam engine. This story really highlights the importance of specific local conditions, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The very first commercially successful steam engine, the Newcomen engine from the early 1700s, was, by our standards, frankly terrible.
How so?
It was incredibly inefficient. It burned through enormous amounts of coal to produce relatively little power. So you'd think it was dead end, right?
Seems like it. Why build something so wasteful?
Because it found one specific niche where it was hugely profitable, pumping water out of British coal mines.
Wait, if you use so much coal, how could it be profitable at a coal mine?
Because the fuel was essentially free right there at the pit head. They were often burning waste coal, stuff that was difficult to transport and sell anyway. And what was the alternative for pumping water out of deep mines?
Horses. Lots of horses.
Exactly. Teams of horses walking in circles, powering pumps. And horses were expensive. You had to buy them, feed them, house them, have people manage them. Compared to the massive cost of horsepower, even the inefficient, coal-hungry Newcomen engine was a bargain at the mine.
Wow. So its inefficiency didn't matter in that one specific context because the fuel cost was zero and the thing it replaced was incredibly expensive.
Precisely. That protected market, that unique economic environment of the coal mine, allowed the steam engine technology to survive, to get established, and crucially, to be tinkered with and improved over decades, eventually leading to James Watt's much more efficient designs later in the century.
Which could then be used in factories, not just mines. That's amazing. The world-changing invention wasn't intended to change the world. It was solving a very practical, local problem, keeping the coal mines dry.
It really drives home the point. Innovation responds to specific economic needs speeds and prices. We see a similar thing with iron production too, right?
Yeah, the breakthrough by Abraham Darby using coke, which is purified coal instead of charcoal, for smelting iron ore.
That was vital. Britain was running out of trees to make charcoal, which was driving the price up. Iron production was hitting a bottleneck. Darby figured out how to use coke, made from Britain's super abundant coal.
So replacing an increasingly expensive resource, wood, with a cheap one, coal.
Exactly. It broke that resource constraint and allowed for the mass production of cheap iron, which of course was essential for building all the new machines, steam engines, railways, you name it.
It all connects back to those relative prices. And if we look at how this British technology eventually spread around the world, does that support Allen's theory too?
Very much so. He argues that the pattern of diffusion confirms the thesis. Where did British industrial technology first get adopted successfully?
Places with similar conditions, like high wages.
Right. Places like the northeastern United States, Belgium, parts of Germany and France eventually. Places where wages were relatively high and catching up to Britain's, making labor-saving machinery increasingly attractive.
But it took longer to get to places with very low wages.
Yes. It wasn't until the technologies themselves were significantly improved, what Allen calls micro-inventions, making them much more fuel-efficient, cheaper to build, easier to run, that they finally became profitable even in countries where labor was very cheap. The technology had to adapt to different factor prices.
So technology transfer isn't just about sharing blueprints. It's about whether the economics stack up in the new location. Okay, this brings us nicely to summing up some of the key themes from Allen's work. Theme one seems crystal clear. It's economic incentives, not just genius, that drive technological change.
Yeah, that's fundamental. We love the stories of brilliant inventors, but Allen forces us to see innovation as a business activity. People invest in developing new technologies when there's a clear profit to be made, and that profit signal comes directly from the relative prices of things like labor, capital, and energy.
It's about responding to the market saying, hey, labor is really expensive, find a way around that.
Exactly. Save on labor, use more coal. That was the message in 18th century Britain.
Theme two is about, well, how fragile this all was. It wasn't inevitable, was it?
Not at all. That's Allen's point about contingency. We tend to look back and think the Industrial Revolution was destined to happen, the next logical step for humanity. But he argues it was highly dependent on that very specific, unusual combination of high wages and cheap coal found only in Britain at that time.
So if Britain hadn't developed its global trade quite the same way, maybe wages wouldn't have been so high. Or if its coal seams had been deeper and harder to access.
History could have gone very differently. Maybe slower technological change, maybe happening somewhere else much later, maybe not the same kind of change. It really underscores that major historical shifts can hinge on quite specific economic alignments.
And the third theme is a bit more sobering. It's about who actually benefited, especially early on. Allen talks about Engel's pause. What's that?
Engel's pause refers to a period roughly from the late 1700s, maybe up to the 1840s or 1860s, where even though the British economy was clearly industrializing and national output was growing rapidly,
the average worker wasn't really seeing the benefits.
That's the tough part. Real wages for ordinary working class people largely stagnated or even fell during those early decades. All the wealth being generated was flowing mostly to the owners of the factories, the capital, the mines.
Why was that? Just exploitation.
Partly the harsh conditions, the disruption of old ways of life, rapid population growth keeping labor supply high, but also the technology itself was initially very focused on replacing labor, not necessarily making the remaining labor much more valuable right away. It took time and further technological development, plus eventually worker organization, for the gains to be shared more broadly.
That's such a crucial historical lesson, especially when we think about automation and AI today, isn't it? Progress doesn't automatically mean prosperity for everyone, at least not immediately.
Absolutely. It highlights that lag, that potential divergence between overall economic growth and the well-being of the average person during big technological shifts.
Allen is great at summing up these big ideas in memorable ways. You mentioned his books are quite clear.
Yeah, he has some lines that really stick with you because they encapsulate the core arguments so well.
Let's pull out a few key quotes or ideas. How about this one? The Industrial Revolution was invented in Britain in the 18th century because it was profitable there and not elsewhere.
Boom. Right there. It immediately shifts the focus from, say, culture or science to pure business calculation. Profitability was the key differentiator.
Okay, second one, really emphasizing the cause. High wages were the driving force behind the Industrial Revolution, since they provided the incentive to invent technologies that substituted capital for labor.
That's the counterintuitive engine, isn't it? High labor costs weren't a bug. They were the feature that sparked the whole process. It incentivized finding ways around extensive labor.
It really flips the script. And a third one, grounding the big inventions in practical reality. The steam engine was not invented to usher in the Industrial Revolution, but to pump water out of coal mines.
Yeah, I love that one. It reminds us that these groundbreaking innovations often start by solving very specific, mundane, local problems. They weren't necessarily conceived with grand, world-changing ambitions. The ambition was just, how do we keep this mine from flooding without spending a fortune on horses?
It makes history feel much more contingent and practical.
Yeah.
Okay, so this isn't just fascinating history. Alan's framework seems really applicable today, right? How can we use this logic now?
Oh, definitely. The most obvious application is understanding current technological adoption. Think about robotics, automation, AI. Where are they being developed and deployed most aggressively?
High-wage countries, generally.
Right.
U.S., Germany, Japan, South Korea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because the economic logic is the same as in 18th century Britain. If you have expensive human workers, whether they're on an assembly line or doing complex analysis, there's a strong financial incentive to invest in capital. Robots, software, that can do that work more cheaply.
The relative factor prices still dictate the direction of innovation. Expensive labor pushes towards automation.
Precisely. The principle of substituting expensive inputs with cheaper ones is timeless.
What about for developing countries? What does Alan's work suggest for economic development policy?
It suggests that maybe just trying to import Western technology or copy Western institutions isn't the whole answer. You need to create the underlying economic conditions that make advanced technology profitable locally.
Meaning?
Things like investing in education and infrastructure to raise worker productivity, which eventually pushes wages up naturally, creating stable institutions. This helps build that internal high-wage, high-skill environment where investing in modern industry actually makes sense for businesses rather than relying solely on cheap, low-skill labor.
So focus on building the foundations that create the incentive for industrialization, not just trying to plonk factories down.
Kind of, yeah. You need to make it economically rational for businesses to invest in more advanced methods.
And finally, his work helps explain the huge gaps we see in the world today, the global inequality.
Immensely. That early lead Britain got, thanks to its unique factor prices, set off what economic historians call the Great Divergence. Britain and the places that could quickly adopt its methods pulled away economically from the rest of Es World.
And that created a kind of lock-in.
Yeah, a cumulative process. Early industrializers developed skills, infrastructure, and further innovations that reinforced their advantage, making it incredibly difficult for countries stuck with low wages and different price structures to catch up. The initial conditions, Alan argues, cast a very long shadow.
Wow. Okay, as we wrap up this deep dive, what's one final thought or maybe something that surprised you most about Alan's perspective?
For me, I think it's just how powerful that simple logic of prices is. It cuts through so much complexity. The idea that high wages, something often seen purely as a cost, were actually the crucial precondition for the leap into modern growth is, well, it's paradigm shifting. It really makes you rethink the dynamics of innovation.
Yeah, I agree. My takeaway is similar. It's the realization that this massive historical event wasn't some grand destiny unfolding, but the result of very specific, almost mundane economic calculations made by individuals responding to the prices they faced. It demystifies it, but also makes it more understandable and maybe even replicable if the conditions are right. It puts economics right at the center of historical change.
It's a powerful lens, for sure. Demystifying history and maybe offering some clues about the future, too.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.